Honey and everybody, welcome back to the Mawa Dissing Show. I am Nicole Bukinage.
And I'm Shirley Nordrum. So this season our show is going to focus on artists. We were talking about this last year, about what we wanted to do. And when you think artist, you think, oh, maybe you think of a painting or a drawing or something. But as we started having these conversations, we were like, you know what? What about martial arts? We have some, you know, native martial artists. And what about? And we started doing all the what abouts. And, you know, there's it's an art to living, right? There's all different kind of arts. So we started developing our list of, you know, who did we want to interview and why did we want to interview them? And then the big question, is that somebody that'll talk on the radio? Because that's always a question. There's so many people out there with so many stories, but they feel a bit intimidated about the radio. So that's always a challenge. And as we started putting together our list of, you know, people, you know, Jim Northrup was on the list. Mm-hmm. And one day I was in the office early and Nicole comes rolling in just fast and she's like, hey, guess who's up on the hill?
And Shirley was like, Chuck Norris.
No. Hey, she said guess. And I was like, Jim Northrup. No, I didn't really. I was like, no, who's up there? And she said, Jim Northrup. And I was like, wow, how cool is that? You know, we don't need to go rolling over to, you know, Fond du Lac. And the thing was, is he was here for a while. He was making baskets with our community, passing on his tremendous skill and art to community members that wanted to learn. So, you know, we were lucky enough to visit with him for quite some time. So what we have here is part one of a two-part series. And Jim started out by sharing with us how he met his wife, Pat. Enjoy.
I snagged her up. We're working in Duluth, and her office is down in the basement, prevention and intervention. Mine is upstairs at Indian Legal. There's only one photocopy machine in that whole building. So I was down there, I went to make some copies, and I looked, and I said, whoa. But pretty soon I was making photocopies of just plain paper.
Run down and make a copy.
Yeah, I'll get some copies here. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So now that old guy is there again, I'm thinking.
So did you say 27? 27
oh, it's 28. I'm not 27. Warner.
That's a long time.
I was 28. I'm 65 now.
Robbing the cradle.
Years young. And he's 72.
It's not the model, it's the mileage.
Right.
I got a lot of miles on me.
Bob Jourdain gave us the name Mawa Dissing. We're just a visiting place, visiting around with people about all kinds of things. And then when we proposed to our next round of shows, at the end of our other round, we were kind of interviewing those up-and-coming young comedians.
Oh, yeah.
That was kind of, that was fun. And I said, well, why don't we focus our next show on art, you know? But as I started thinking about art, I mean, life is art, right? And no matter what, I mean, you could be a gardener or you could be a martial artist or a basket maker. It's all art.
She got art busting out of her. Nothing else to do, she paints the light switches.
What? I do.
Yeah.
Floral designs and all. Yeah. Beadwork.
So that's kind of what this is about, is just finding people that are, you know, open to having a conversation on the radio. For one, that's not an easy thing. A lot of people don't feel comfortable with that. The other thing is kind of, I guess, you got to be able to talk about yourself a bit. So some people aren't comfortable with that. So we started making a list, and you were on the list, but amazingly enough, you were sitting in our backyard. We didn't have to go anywhere. That was he's up there right now. Let's go see if he will do that. And
well,
technology. Let's see.
Yeah. All I can say is I was born at a very early age. At the government hospital at Fond du Lac. And when I was six, I went to Pipestone. And I fought my way through there for 4 years or so. I came home and lived on Franklin Avenue, near Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. Went to school down there. Then I went to a Christian boarding school in Hot Springs, South Dakota. It was kind of an interesting time then, because I was a teenager then. It wasn't so miserable. The federal boarding school in Pipestone was a miserable place. The story I remember most was a little boy had begun quietly crying at one end of the dormitory. Maybe he was crying because he was beat up. Maybe he was crying because he'd been sexually abused. Whatever the reason, the boys on either side of him would tell him to be quiet. And when he wouldn't stop crying, they'd be reminded how homesick they were, and they'd start crying too. You could hear the wave of crying start at one end of the dormitory, come traveling down bed to bed, row to row, like that. The whole place was crying, all laying there crying. And we all got up the next morning, pretended like it didn't happen, but it did. So it wasn't a happy place. After a couple months there, I told my older sister Judy that I didn't like it. I wanted to go home. I wanted to see my ma's face again. So she tried to talk me out of it, but couldn't. So she gave me a piece of sugar cake to take with me to walk home with. And we used to get sugar cakes from my grandma. Once a month we'd get one, and Judy was the keeper of the cakes. She'd have a handkerchief and about 15 knots on it. And she'd untie it and I'd take a little bite. And just that little taste was enough to bring me home, because I knew who made it and I know what they went through to make it. So I was familiar with all that. So that was my connection to home. So then even years later, after I was grown up and traveling around the world, I get sugar cakes from my grandma. And now we make them. I don't send them off to anybody, though. I keep them all for myself.
Oh, everybody in the community finds out that we're making sugar. Wow. Facebook.
Yeah.
We're on Facebook. And like 3 days later, gone.
Yeah.
All of them. I think that mainly that's from we got married the old way, the split the pipe. With Jimmy Jackson, one of the things he told us when he counseled us before we got married was, because there's no divorce, and when you marry through the pipe, there's certain things you get, how you live your life, he suggested. One of the things is, when people come to your home, feed them or give them something to drink. So we always do that. You know, make them welcome, make them feel at home. So we do that.
Mostly.
Yeah, most of the time.
It was three women who came from another country in Europe, and they wanted to come and interview me, but Pat didn't like them. So there was no interview.
So you're here on Leech Lake making baskets, teaching folks how to make your baskets. Amazing craftsmanship. I took some pictures, so those pictures will be alongside that interview, so people can see that basket. How'd you get going doing the baskets?
Well, about 40 years ago, I looked around, and when I was a kid, you go to anybody's house, there'd be somebody sewing something on birch bark in the backyard, or you know, up in a patio or wherever. And I looked around about 40 years ago, and there was nobody doing it anymore. I said, well, I know a little bit about it. I watched my grandpa. So I started sewing baskets, and we made every mistake you can make on them baskets. I learned from it, you know, every mistake. So now it's just like our hands know how to do it. You don't even have to think about it. Just, oh yeah, this comes next, and this comes next. Is the way we do it. So we make all of our own tools, the awls. It's been good for us. There was a time when I didn't have a job, I didn't have no income, and we just made baskets. And one year we made 50 of them. Those are all-time high, I think.
Yeah.
And as they become, more better looking, we start raising our price. And then pretty soon we start getting invites from museums to come and demonstrate how we make them. So we've been to the Smithsonian twice, once in New York and once in Washington, and been to other various museums in Minnesota, the Science Museum and History Museum, all around the museums. And there's one museum in Evanston, Illinois. They wanted a used basket. A used basket. I didn't know what to charge for a used basket. I know what I charge for a new one, but a used one? So I called some other museum people, and I said, you know, what's going on here? And they said, well, they want it authentic. They want to authenticate it. So they said, charge them double. I said, okay. So I showed up in Evanston, Illinois with the basket, and I said, here you go, ma'am. Here's your basket. She said, oh, very nice, very nice. How much? I said, $400. She says, what? I said, yeah, it's used. See, the rice in the corner? See the burn marks? See my sweat marks on it? It's used. Oh, okay. She peeled off some 20s and started pounding them out. I said, oh, know anybody else who wants to buy a basket? I got more used ones at home.
You gotta know your worth, though, huh?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, you know, to make this basket, you have to go out in the woods for hours and gather all the supplies, the bark, the willow, the basswood, the weegub. Then you have to come home, and then you have to prep it. You know, you have to strip the bark for the basswood, the weegub. Then you have to make it and figure. We figured about 12 hours per basket, but that in the selling of it, you don't include all the time you spend out in the woods.
One time we
were going along in the ditch banks at Fond du Lac. They got the ditch banks out there, and we were cruising along looking for bark. And they got the waters running through, so you have to go get over on the other side. Well, we were cruising along, we seen a really nice tree over there. But we had to get across, so we went along like that, and we seen a log going across. So old Jim gets out, and we park the car, Jim gets out, and he dances across that log. Oh, it's probably about from here to the building across, maybe not quite as wide. And then it's my turn. Oh, my God. So I'm crawling, going fast, crawling, and then I can't go anymore. I freeze up. So he had to talk me across to get over there. Then I think after I got over there, I have to get back. Oh my God! We got the bark pole.
Yeah.
I think I'd have been crawling too.
Oh my gosh!
Balance isn't one of my.
Oh.
Things I'm good at. So you're thinking about, I think people value art and they devalue it at the same time. It seems like the artist has to be famous or dead or something before you pay extravagant prices for it. But if you were going to, start itemizing like lawyers do, okay, I spent this many hours going get it. I had to pay gas. I had wear and tear in my car. I had, you know, if you start stacking the actual expenses, so what do you think a basket would cost if you did something like that?
At least minimum 500.
Yeah.
For
a degree.
For
the big ones.
For the big ones, yeah.
Yeah, the ones that are used for New Scotch and Ogden.
Mm-hmm. If we sold, would we sell like 5 of them in downtown Minneapolis at this art place? And I think we got 400 a piece for each of them. And they gave it to us with no hesitation at all, like it was nothing. Went back and looked, and they were selling it 8 to 1,000. But they sold them.
They sold right away.
So
that's the thing about that, like consignment, or when you do that, somebody buys it, puts it in a store, and then, you know, they're marketing to a different
yep.
group of people, yep. and then boom, mm-hmm. they get, mm-hmm. you know, they triple their money.
Yeah. And the I think the marketing and the selling of any of our indigenous arts, that we, the artists, don't get what it's really worth. I mean, when you really think about it, I mean, well, we know people that do completely beaded bags and they sell them for, what, $300-$400? Worth more than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got your time involved, you got all the materials you have to gather up, you have to sit there and think of the design, I mean, the mathematics of it, and where it's all going to go. You have to picture it beforehand. I mean, that's all an art. That's all what makes you an artist. You have to have that spirit to even do that piece of art. Because without it, it's not going to be what it should be. You know, without that mm-hmm. spirit. You have to have that willingness, you have to have that good mind in order to even approach all the arts and the indigenous arts. Especially the ones where you go out in the woods and get, because you're offering tobacco. And so there has to be a mm-hmm. different mindset to work with it. Or if you don't have that, then it's not going to be what it's supposed to be. Something will happen, the wiggle will break, the basswood would break, the bark will break, something. Something always happens. So
stab yourself with the awl.
Oh, yeah. Cut yourself with a knife. I mean, it's always something. So at that point, if your mind isn't right with it, then you just take a break. So I think it's really, it helps to de-stress when you're doing this kind of art.
It's a little different when I sit down to write a poem or to write a story. I usually get hurt and I say, listen, I want to tell this story. I want to tell you this story. And that's my actual first draft, is when I tell her the story. And I get it down on the page. And then I can start working with it. Add descriptions and things like that. Build the character or whatever. Illustrate the place. And it's all based on what I told her. But it's a story that, you know, it grows beyond me. And then if I'm writing poetry, it depends on the effect I'm going to have on the audience. If I want to make them laugh, I can make them laugh. If I want to make them cry, I can make them cry. And it's a power that I've been given. It's not egotistical to say that, but maybe I can give you an example of a sad one, a sad poem that might make you cry. Then I'll recite a poem that is kind of sad at first, but then halfway through, you find yourself laughing, and so it's okay to do that. But the sad one first is called Grandma's Hair. It was really crazy at times. Once we got caught out in this big rice paddy, bad guys started shooting at us. I was close to the front of the formation, so I got inside the tree line quick. They couldn't see me anymore. When I leaned over to catch my breath, I heard the snick, snick, bang sound of someone firing a bolt-action rifle, shooting at the Marines still out in a rice paddy. I could tell where he was from the sound of his rifle. Snick, snick, bang. I fired a 3-round burst at the noise. That ass turned and fired at me. I saw the muzzle flash, heard the bullet snap by at the same time. I fired another 3-round burst. I moved closer. Then, the little opening in the brush, I could see what looked like a pile of rags, bloody rags. I went over and gave him one in the head to make sure. We used to do that all the time, one in the head to make sure. When my 7.62 bullet hit, it knocked his hat off. When his hat came off, all his hair comes spilling out. It was a woman. She had hair like my grandma's. Okay, second one now. This one is probably my most famous one. It's one that I kind of like because my son came home from high school English, 7th grade, and brought his textbook. He says, I got to read a short story. I said, okay, you read it, and I'll read it, and we'll talk about it. So he said, but first let me show you this. And he went a couple more pages, and there were two of my poems in there, in his high school textbook. I felt pretty good about that. It was, you know, the school I graduated from, So the poem is called Shrinking Away. Survived the war, but was having trouble surviving the peace. Couldn't sleep more than 2 hours. Scared to be without a gun. Nightmares. Daymares. Guilt and remorse. Wanted to stay drunk all the time. 1966, and the VA said Vietnam wasn't a war. They couldn't help, but did give me a copy of the Yellow Pages. Picked a shrink off the list, $50 an hour. I was making $125 a week. We spent 6 sessions establishing rapport. I heard about his military life, his homosexuality, his fights with his mother, and anything else he wanted to talk about. At this rate, we would have got to me in 1999. Gave up on that shrink. Couldn't afford him. Wasn't doing me any good. 6 weeks later, my shrink killed himself. Great. Not only guilt about the war, but new guilt about my dead shrink. If only I had a better job, I could have kept on seeing him. I thought we were making real progress. Maybe in another 6 sessions, I could have helped him. I realized then, surviving the peace was up to me. Does that illustrate it then, what I was trying to say?
Yeah.
Well, through it all, I saw some terrible things over there. War is terrible. And I saw some terrible things that I'll never forget. So I can write it down, put it in the pages of a book, close the book and put it away for a while. It isn't, in the forefront of my mind.
Yeah, so you're kind of talking about something that I've been thinking about for a while now, is that art is healing. Whatever that art is, we've been carving as a community around here since, I don't know, when we started, sometime before the holiday last year, and we bought a bunch of knives, and we find a center that's open on a Saturday or Sunday, and we just kind of, mostly by word of mouth or a few phone calls, say, hey, we're going to get together and carve.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some times when some people that are in recovery, they actually have to come with someone else, they're in recovery. They're saying that, I can lose myself in this. This is what I need.
Mm-hmm.
But they also want the social part of everybody coming together, so you can talk and laugh. But I guess I never really thought about art or poetry or all those things, the healing power of the arts. It's healing, isn't it?
Yeah. I wanted to write about something that had nothing to do with the war. I wanted to see if I could do, something with that. And so I wrote a play called Schnob Jep. It's a parody of the game show Jeopardy. And it's got all Indian content, all Indian characters. When we do it on stage, I play the part of Al Treebark, the host of the show. And then there's a female person on the play. Her name is... She makes syrup in the spring, she sews baskets, and she makes rice, and watches kids the rest of the time, I guess. But anyway, her name is Trudish Ikwe. And then there's an Amester kind of a guy. He's from Minneapolis, enrolled at White Earth. His name is Franklin Lake. And then there's an adopted out Chinab, born Indian but raised white. He's an engineer at Control Data, and his name is John Johnson Jr. And when they first start off, the two Indian contestants don't really trust him because he looks like a white guy. Tassel loafers and a sport coat and looks a little nice little haircut. So they don't really trust him. They accept him. So then the categories are silly, trick or treaties, trick or treatment, race relations, racing, sugar bush. It's just a half hour of silly, and it's got commercials. Bougat's Wild Rice Tools. And it's just like I say, it's a half hour silly. We've done it about 10 times now in Wisconsin, at Mille Lacs, even down in Minneapolis, and Little Rock, Arkansas once.
Huh.
And then we did it in Milwaukee, Indian Summer. So we've done it a few times, and it's a lot of fun. We did it at the Black Bear Casino, and they started. I gave them a copy of the script, and I gave them a video of the performance, and we rehearsed on stage. And about 10 minutes before I was supposed to go on, they said, Jim, you're going to have to change the script. And I said, I don't think so. I said, we've been rehearsing this for 10 days. You know, you could have told us beforehand, but now it's too late. It's got to go as it goes. And they said, well, some of that language is pretty rough. And I said, yeah, I know. I wrote it that way. I said, this is not an after-school special. This is not Sunday school. This is an Indian casino on Saturday night. So word is in there. The F word, I mean. You have to edit that out, I think. FCC and all that. But anyway, to get the full gist of the story, my son played the part of Franklin Lake. And the question is, respond to the following statement. My grandmother is a real Cherokee princess. And he answers, who gives the F word? And and just as it gets to who gives, they turned off his microphone.
Oh,
censorship,
gosh.
On the res. I said, I'm not changing it. You know, the Indian Civil Rights Act gives me freedom of speech on the reservation. And this is a reservation. If they'd read the script a little further, they would have seen that I repeat his answer. Who gives a F word? Is the correct response to my grandmother is. Then there's a second part in there about five questions, and the answers are all the same. Crazy Horse, a Lakota. Who never drove a res car? Crazy Horse, a Lakota. It's just, like I say, a half hour is silly. Mm-hmm. But it teaches cooperation rather than competition. And so I think I did pretty good with that play. And now I understand it's going to be used here.
That's something I've always thought this community could use, is like some type of, I don't know, play. Like they get, right down the road they have Paul Bunyan. I hate Paul Bunyan, but They have the Paul Bunyan Playhouse, and they're always doing plays, and it looks like fun. And I've talked to some folks here that a few times there have been plays, like at the Tribal College, and everyone enjoyed them, so I don't know why it's not done, you know?
Yeah.
If it makes people happy and brings people together, I don't know why we don't do it.
Well, it's a half hour of fun, this play. It's just fun. Mm-hmm. And not a word about Vietnam in there. So that was a success.
And so that is going to conclude the first episode of the two-part series with Jim Northrup. Be sure to tune into the next episode. One thing that Jim mentioned was his poetry, and he recited the Grandma's Hair poem. And that kind of brought me back to a memory as a young woman when I first was introduced to Jim and his writings. And so that was actually the very first piece that I had read from him as an author. And so that was kind of a treat to be able to sit there and listen to him recite it right there. And so that was kind of a special piece for me. The guy's funny, he's interesting, and so be sure to tune in to the next episode, Ahau Miigwech.
This program has been funded by the Legacy Arts, Culture, and Heritage Fund of Minnesota.